Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
I'm a fan of The Vanished podcast. Sometimes I will listen to the podcast while I'm working, and I'm like, oh, I can see exactly who did this. Or, you know, you have it solved, and you know that everybody else knows who did it, but you just can't prove it. And it's just so mind-boggling that it's 2019 and people get away with murder. You think that as much, you know, technology and DNA and forensic work that is done and how they can take one drop of blood and figure out who it is, and, you know, all the miraculous scientific advancements that we've made, and people are getting away with murder. I feel like the mental illness piece of it is downplaying the years that he was captain of the sheriff's department and was a law-abiding enforcer within the city and helped make sure that people were safe. And I feel like that's all just no one cares. Not that that should get him special treatment at all, but the fact that he has a mental illness should not be just that he gets discarded as a human being. My sisters and I were not close to our dad in the last years, but we would like to know what happened to him. We want closure. He was in Pegram, I feel like, 3 months prior to my dad's disappearance. There was a woman in Nashville who was picked up in a cab, and she was found dead the next morning on the side of the road. She'd been run over, what they think, by the cab. Say this taxi driver is involved. I mean, that's the last person who saw him.
On May 8th, 2013, 69-year-old John Brewer left his residence in Nashville, Tennessee, and took a taxi cab to his bank, which was located in Pegram, Tennessee. Once there, he asked for $500 cash and started acting strangely in the bank. Eventually, the bank staff asked John to leave and closed his account. He was last seen walking out of the bank and getting back into the cab. He has never been seen or heard from again. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 191 of The Vanished, John Brewer's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Years prior to his disappearance, John Brewer had retired from his career as a captain in the Davidson County Sheriff's Department. In the years leading up to his disappearance, John's mental health began to deteriorate. 2 years before he disappeared, in a delusional state, John believed that he was a U.S. Marshal and that his neighbor was a fugitive. He broke into his neighbor's home and tried to arrest him. John was charged with aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping, and violation of a protective order. John went to court and the judge sentenced him to reside at a state mental health facility. The judge believed that a mental health facility could better care for his needs than living independently or going to prison. The mental health facility eventually transitioned him to a nearby halfway house, and this is where he was living when he disappeared. Due to his mental health issues, John's relationships with his daughters had deteriorated. They now know that this estrangement was caused by his mental health issues. We spoke to John's daughters Glinda and Brandy for this story. They told us about their father and what they remember of his life. Here's Glinda.
I'm his daughter. Glinda's the oldest. She's 3 years older than me. So they had Glinda and then they had me 3 years later. And then 14 and a half years later, they had Brandy. It gets worse. Our middle names rhyme as well. Glinda and I were both so adamant when my mom was going to have Brandy. We were like, absolutely, her name has to be something completely different. You cannot, you know, name her anything related to Glinda or Glinda. So my dad, he had 9 brothers and sisters. And my dad lost his dad when he was 4 years old. He got killed in a car wreck here in Nashville. And so my grandmother had all these babies and then she remarried. They struggled. They didn't have a lot. My dad always worked. Even as a young teenager, he worked. He worked on a farmer's truck. He was selling produce. Whatever job he could get, he would do. My dad was one of 9. My mother was one of 16. And so there were lots of mouths to feed. And both of them came from families that had very little. Very rich in love and the non-material things, but really struggled when it comes to clothing the kids, providing for the kids, things like that. Both of my parents had very strong work ethic. For me, growing up, my parents were very hard workers. They made sure that we had, our house was one of the nicer houses on our block. We had all kinds of toys, I would say above and beyond what you'd like for your birthday. Over and beyond, they always made sure that we had everything that we needed. So much to the point that even Glinda had a really close friend in school whose parents were much older and they were on a fixed income. And so whenever we would want to do something and we would want our friends to go, our parents would pay for our friends to go as well. My dad was really strict on us growing up. You know, we were very respectful to our elders. We always said, yes, sir, no, sir. They wanted to ensure that we had really good morals and respect, that we knew right from wrong. My dad being in law enforcement, you know, he always made sure that if there was a lesson, you know, that we needed to know, he told us. Growing up, the earlier part of my childhood, I mean, he was strict, but he was a very loving dad.
John and his wife eventually divorced, leaving young Brandy in the middle of a custody dispute. Glinda told us about the strange turns the custody dispute took.
Over time, as I got older, my parents separated when I was about 14 or 15, my dad was having an affair with Monica. He told us he was going to go work on a roofing job in another city, and then he just never came back. So after he and my mom divorced, he married Monica. They lived in Pegram. As my little sister, Brandy, you know, my mom died and I fought my dad for custody of Brandy. and he won, and then he turned around and gave custody of her back to me. And I think he was having mental issues back then. You know, hindsight 2020, and we knew it was like, what has this person turned into?
While speaking with Brandy, we asked her to tell us about her childhood as she remembers it.
My childhood with my dad is very, very different from my sister's because of the age difference. I don't remember him as a child. He had basically taken off and had started shacking up with my stepmother pretty early on in my life. So I remember he called me one time when I was 5 years old and promised me a pony. And then outside of that, I didn't see him again until I was 10. He took my mom to court and had visitation set up through the court because I did not know him. The judge in Nashville did like a ramp up where, you know, he didn't get Friday to Sunday right off the rip. It was, I went to church with him on Sundays, and he would bring me home at dinner time. And then it was overnight. And then it was the full every other weekend, like most non-custodial parents have. In those times, my mom got sick in June of 95, and then she passed away in August of 95. And in the state of Tennessee, when you have a split custody situation and one parent passes away, custody typically automatically reverts to the other parent. June 1st of 96 until sometime in July of 96, I lived with him full time. I guess you could say hindsight's 2020. Looking back and being an adult, I can see where the mental illness was starting to show itself. Really irrational things he would make me do, like he would have me load wood in the back of a dump truck, and as soon as I got it back the way he had asked for it, he would go and push the button and dump it all out and have me do it again. My relationship with him was never good. I recall on more than one occasion telling him, if you love me, because he would tell me he loved me. And I would say, you know, if you love me the way that you say you do, you will drive off and you will never seek me out. And I was 12 years old telling him this. My dad called my sister at work and said, you know, if you give me your part of what you got from your mom's house, he said, I'll sign over custody of Brandy. And so that's how my sister came to be my guardian. So she raised me. And then all through my teens, I lived in fear that he was going to show back up. Again, hindsight 2020, I'm like, that's mental illness. My dad is not a bad person. It took a long time to figure that out.
After the divorce, John remarried a woman named Monica, who was also a law enforcement officer. And they seemed happy together. However, as John's mental health worsened, his life started to spiral downward. Glinda told us about some of the things going on in John's life at the time of his disappearance.
I think that there was some drinking and some over-medicating going on, and they would get into these fights. He and Monica were arguing, fighting. She had him arrested. He went to live with his friends, Judy and Ben Huberry. And so he stayed with them for a while. Ben actually told me that he had seen them fighting before and that Monica had knocked the crap out of Johnny and basically knocked him out of a chair. Well, my dad was 6'2", 250. And she's about 6 foot or so, maybe 300. I mean, I don't know if he did hit her. I can tell you this, my parents were married 24, 25 years, and they got into some pretty heated arguments. But I had never in my entire life saw my dad lay a finger on my mother. Never. So he got arrested. So he moved out. He had to leave because she got a restraining order against him. So he went to Ben and Judy Hubery. They noticed that he was acting very weird and strange. And so he was there a little while and they were like, look, this is not really working. You're going to have to move on. So then he rented a room from one of his friends in East Nashville. And then somehow he wound up in a condo in Madison, Tennessee, which is a suburb of Nashville. And while he was at the condo, his mental illness was getting really worse and worse. You know, he had been in law enforcement for a long time. Obviously, he was finished with law enforcement and wasn't working at 70, but he felt like that he was a U.S. Marshal, okay? He was convinced that he was a U.S. Marshal. And he thought the neighbor across the hall from him was doing something illegal. So he goes over to the neighbor's, pulls a gun on the neighbor. It's a blessing that he did not hurt the neighbor or that the neighbor didn't kill him, because the neighbor was able to pull his shirt up over his head and get the gun away from him and get away from him and call the police. Well, he got arrested. And when he got arrested for that, he went and did a mental evaluation, and they determined that he had to go to Middle Tennessee Mental Health. Part of the resolution to those charges, the neighbor agreed this guy's mentally ill, and he's 70, years old, or 68, or however old he was at the time, that he didn't need to go to prison. He needed to go get mental health. Part of the plea deal of those charges, which they bundled in the charge from Monica into all of that, was that he be remanded to Middle Tennessee Mental Health. So he went to Middle Tennessee Mental Health. He was there for a while. He was put on medications, very strong psychotic medications. After an amount of time, he was released to a group home. And he lived at that group home with my aunt as his conservator. She would go and visit him and take care of him and get everything that he needed. And so he lived there for a while. And then she told me that he had been sent back to Middle Tennessee Mental Health, stayed there for a little while. Then they determined that he could once again go to a group home.
As I mentioned earlier, John had been living in a halfway house after having been in a residential mental health facility. Glinda walked us through the events of the day that he disappeared.
He goes to the group home there on Jefferson Street, L.B. Jackson. He's there maybe a week, and then it's May 8th. And he either flags down a yellow cab, calls a yellow cab, somehow or another gets in a yellow cab, according to the employee who was working there. Now, he's got his wits about him to know my money is at Community Bank and Trust in Pegram, Tennessee. He takes a taxi to the bank. He goes into the bank. He causes some sort of ruckus because they closed his bank account the next day. But he goes in. He withdraws $500. That's not all the money he has in his account. But at first he only wanted like $200 or $300, and then he decided he wanted $500. So he withdraws $500. He goes back out. He gets in the cab. He's never seen again. Never seen anywhere.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. According to John's family, he had been diagnosed with grandiose delusion disorder, and this may explain some of the events that took place on the last day that he was seen. Glinda and her sisters were concerned after this incident, but because they had been estranged from their father for so long, they weren't sure if he was actually missing or if he had just fallen out of contact.
My sisters and I, we were estranged from our dad because of the situation with Brandy and me having to fight him for custody, getting her back, the whole deal. And so my aunt, she was taking care of my dad. And so he tells us that he's missing. My aunt is actually on the news. He goes missing on like a Tuesday or Wednesday. My aunt is on the news within a couple of days because she is very worried about the community. She's afraid that he's going to think he's a U.S. Marshal and try to hurt somebody. So the group home told my aunt that they made a missing person report. My aunt called the police again and was like, "You don't understand. He is a threat. He could hurt someone. I don't want him to hurt anybody. You guys have got to find him."
As Glinda and her sisters started searching for their dad, they kept running into frustrating roadblocks when it came to John's wife, Monica.
After he's missing, Monica is trying to divorce him, okay? We are going to probate court, because that's where his conservatorship is. That's where the divorce is taking place. They've moved it all under one judge here in Nashville. She managed to do that, and she managed to get his widow's pension, which I'm not really sure how that's going to work because she's not a widow anymore, when he's declared dead. Every single thing. She got the house outright. She got every personal belonging that he had. She got all the money in his account. So the court, in getting the divorce, the court said, well, it's to everybody's benefit to find him, so let's hire a private investigator to look for him. his conservatorship will pay half and Monica should pay half because, you know, it's her benefit to fund him so she can get her divorce. It was very difficult because, you know, Monica is a former sergeant of the Metro Nashville Police Department. And her attorney is a former Metro police officer. A lot of the private investigators around here are former Metro police officers. I threw a big fit and was adamant that it not be a former Metro police officer to investigate him being missing and looking for him. And so we finally agreed upon a private investigator. The private investigator does a little bit of preliminary work, and then all of a sudden, he tells me that he can't, you know, I called to see where he is with his investigation. And he says, well, I can't speak to you. I can only speak to your aunt. I said, no problem. I'm going to call her right now and have her call you. And he tells my aunt that the work has been halted by the attorney. And so it literally takes a year to get the private investigator to look for him and try to find him. He finds no trace of him.
While his wife was trying to get a divorce from her missing husband, John's family discovered that no police report had ever been filed in 2013 when John had disappeared.
He has an attorney that for the conservatorship who's helping my aunt look out for his best interest. And in a discussion with the attorney, my aunt is older, and so my aunt didn't email and, you know, really text much during this time. It was a struggle to get the attorney to respond a lot of times. My aunt would call me. I would email him and say, hey, look, this is what she wants to know. And so he would respond. And then I would call her and, you know, read her the email. During that time, he called me, the attorney, and he said, there is no missing person report for your dad. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And he said, no. He said, I just checked. There's no missing person report. And I said, but the group home stated they filed a missing person report. Aunt Mary called the police again because she was worried. I said, they know he's missing. He goes, you're going to have to call and get a missing person report done. My Aunt Mary called the police. They came over. They refused to take a report because it had been 3 years at that time. I turned around and I emailed the chief of police of Nashville, Steve Anderson, and said, hey, we have a problem here. He's missing. No one's even made a report or looking for him or anything. And so within 30 minutes, a sergeant called me and gave me instructions on this is how you get the police report filed, give them his name, make sure they understand he's aware. And he wanted me to call him back if they would not take the report. We finally got them to take the report. So in 2016, they took the missing person report.
After the family successfully filed a police report with local authorities, they wanted to know what was going on in the investigation to find John. But the police were reticent to give out any information.
This was Metro Nashville Police Department because he was living on Jefferson Street, okay, which is in Nashville, Davidson County. We wait a little bit. We wait like a month. We don't hear anything from them. My sisters and I start calling them to say, hey, what is going on here? We go down to the police department. Brandy and I give a DNA sample to be loaded into NamUs so that if he comes up, there will be something to match to. The police department said they had gone back and looked through all their missing person reports to make sure it didn't get put in the wrong file, that it wasn't somewhere it shouldn't have been. They could not find the report. And we're like, we don't understand how this could be. And so I even asked them, I figured the group home probably had a lot of calls from the police department just because of the nature of the people living there. My aunt had lived in her home out in the suburbs for probably 40 years. And I knew, I'm like, I don't know that she really ever called the police. And so I said, can you do a reverse search on my aunt's address? And you should see where the police were called to her home in May of 2013. And that you can see who the police officer was that she said she gave the report to. They came back and they said, we have no record of a call at that address in 2013. They only had one other call, and it was something about her neighbor had asked her to call the police for him or something. They had no record of the 2013. And she said, they came and sat in my living room. I spoke to them. They were here. It's just very bizarre things like this have happened. 3 years had gone by at that time, and no one had even looked at any of the cab companies, done anything about it. We were starting from way behind to begin with. Unfortunately, the detective, the missing person detective who was assigned to my dad's case, was about 4 or 5 weeks away from retirement. He knew some of my aunts and uncles on my mother's side. And so I was like, oh my gosh, he's going to help us. There's going to be, you know, we're going to find some answers. And we literally had to say, could you please, the bank says they took a report. They won't give us the report. Could you please go and get the report? Could you please check these things? And so I don't think anything at all was done on my dad's case.
John's family continues to remain suspicious of some of his wife's actions. It's important to remember that everyone handles tragedy differently. But I also found some of those things odd myself.
We continue to go to court because Monica, she still wants the restraining order. She still is going through trying to divorce my dad. And so we're kind of dealing with that. We find out that the detective, he did retire. It got moved over to Detective Jolly with the Metro Police Department. My sisters and I contact Detective Jolly, and we go and we meet with him. And he basically says, there really isn't anything we can do unless there's a body. Nothing we can do. And if we find anything, we'll give you a call. But he also says to us, this is really Tatum County's issue because he was last seen in Tatum County. So my sisters and I go, okay, all this time has gone by. You all took the report, told you, we knew exactly where he went missing from. We told you there was no secret that it was in Pegram, which is in Cheatham County. And so now you should really have reported this to Cheatham County. My sister, my older sister, Linda, and my cousin go to Cheatham County to try to do a missing person report. They would not do a missing person report or talk to it. They're like, we're not doing it. Time goes on. Monica actually gets her divorce. She got everything my dad owned. We ask about cadaver dogs going to their property. Because again, it's 6 miles from the bank. The day he went missing from the bank, Monica told my aunt. My aunt called Monica as a courtesy to tell her, hey, he's missing. And she said, I know it. The bank called me. The bank had called her to let her know that he was missing. But she knew that he was at that bank. She's gotten everything in the divorce. She's getting the widow's pension. She financially gained from that. She never called my aunt to say, has he been found? Has anybody heard anything? I mean, you're terrified of him to the point that you've got a restraining order against him. But she never inquires as to what the situation is. Has he been found? Is he back in the hospital? She never calls and never asks. As a matter of fact, my dad's best friend was Friday Blackwood. He is Friday Blackwood. And Friday was the head of the Davidson County Sheriff's Office, the jail where my dad was the captain. And they've been friends for a million years. I don't remember really much time in my life that Friday wasn't my dad's friend, okay? Friday is looking for my dad. He said he would have called me. He would have come to me had he decided to leave the group home. If he had his sense about him enough to know where his money was, to go to his bank, if he had that much sense about him, he said he would have called me. Friday called Monica several times to try to get the address of a cabin. Monica had a cabin in Paris, Tennessee, that her aunt and uncle had left her, willed to her or something. And they would go to that cabin periodically. Friday wanted to go up and search and look around that cabin to see if Johnny was up there. So Monica would not answer the phone when Friday was trying to reach her. Friday said, the guy said he was Monica's attorney, called him and said, why are you trying to reach her? And he said, I want the address of the cabin. I'm trying to find Johnny. And the guy said, well, let me talk to her. I'll call you back. And he calls back and he says, she doesn't want you on her property. And she said that you need to stop looking for Johnny. And he told me this out of his own mouth. This isn't secondhand, fourthhand. I called and talked to him and he said, something bad has happened because your dad would have contacted me. So we're now at 6 years. Nobody's really ever looked for him. Nobody's really done anything. No matter how hard we try, no one is really interested. He's had two sisters die, a brother die. If he were somewhere that he would have showed up at something.
While speaking with Brandy, she also recalled some of Monica's behavior that she found unsettling.
I have a news article. It says, suspected thieves nabbed by homeowner retired officer, and it's copywritten 2013, which is the year my dad disappeared. What started out as an attempt to steal a metal roof from an abandoned home ended with the suspects in the back of a Metro patrol car. Monica Jett, a retired Metro police officer, has owned the home for years. She lived down the road from the property. Jett was alerted to the thief by a concerned neighbor. She immediately retrieved her service revolver, drove down the street a short distance, and confronted the suspects. And so the article goes on, but basically she held these men at gunpoint until the police came. And this was the same year that my dad disappeared. So she, to me, still had that cop mentality. And so I wholeheartedly believe that she could have hurt my dad. Do I think she could have gotten rid of his body by herself? No. My dad built the house that she lived in. And when I say he built the house, I don't mean he designed it and paid someone to build it. He built it. And so one of the things that he was so proud of was that the back deck looked out over this ravine. The only thing I can think of was if she got rid of him by herself, You know, she pushed him off the deck into that ravine and let the animals just do away with him when she was trying to divorce him, which doesn't make any sense to me. Why you would go through the effort of divorcing someone who's missing. She was trying to divorce him. The judge said, you know, I really want Mr. Brewer to come and speak for himself, so we're going to actively search for him. And we're going to hire a private investigator. And so one was hired, and I have spoken to him multiple times. His name is Roger Clemens. And he did a cadaver dog search. At the time, we thought she has three parcels of land in a row. It was our understanding at the time that they were searching all three parcels. Talked to him after the fact, about a year later, and he said, no, it was just one parcel. It was only the parcel that her house is sitting on. When he was doing his investigating, like, he went into her home and searched, but I don't think he did like a formal interview with her. He kept talking about this mound of material in the basement. And he said it was in bags and it was a powder. And I've talked to him three different times since he did his investigation about that mound. And this last time I talked to him just a couple weeks back, and I said, is there any way my dad could have been in that mound? And he said, as big as the mound was, yes. And I've asked him what that mound was, and he just says it's some kind of a building substance. He doesn't know what it was. He thinks it might be bagged concrete. It's not labeled. My stepmother had told him that it was something my dad had bought that he had gotten on sale, which does sound like him. That mound bothers me because I'm like, is that powdered lye?
Even in light of some of these bizarre events, we asked Glinda if she thinks it's possible that her dad could be out there alive somewhere, possibly living among the homeless. This is what she said.
Not saying he might have harmed himself, but if he did, it's not like he could have hid his body afterward, you know what I mean? He would have been wherever he fell, and he would have been discovered by now. Say this taxi driver is involved. I mean, that's the last person who saw him. And if he knew he got money, if he knew he got $500 out of the bank or some amount of money out of the bank, he knew that my dad had money. So if he harmed my dad for the money, then what did he do with his body? I mean, at some point, a hunter, a surveyor, this has been long enough that he would have been found. $500 is long gone, way long gone. He doesn't have any meds. And people are like, well, maybe he's homeless and living on the street. And I'm like, so being homeless, my dad was very street smart, but being homeless is a whole nother level. I feel very, very strongly. Again, my dad's 6'2", 250. I feel like if he were homeless, he would have been caught and arrested by now. Because I feel like if someone would have touched anything that belonged to him, which they steal from each other all the time, if anybody had touched his belongings, he would have tried to kill him. And I feel like he would have caused a ruckus somewhere, and he would have been arrested by now.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Three years had passed before the police department took a missing persons report, and John's family is understandably frustrated with the delayed investigation and has focused instead on their own searches. Here's Glinda's take.
There's a whole different leeway I could go with this and tell you that 3 months prior to my dad's disappearance, there was a woman in Nashville who was picked up in a cab, and she was found dead the next morning on the side of the road. She'd been run over, what they think, by the cab. The case has been very much mishandled. But one thing that came out of that is her family fought with the Metro Council here in Nashville, and they got the law changed so that every cab has to have a GPS and be tracked. And that went into effect right after my dad disappeared. Nobody's cared enough to piece this case and my dad's case. And it's like, what else was going on back during that time? So all of the cabs were inspected. It was up to every cab company to make sure the GPS. And so what the really sad part is here 3 years went by when nothing, not one thing being done. And you can't go back and get that time back, because you could say that law went into effect and it's like, okay, were there, you know, they kept saying he got into a yellow cab. So the yellow cab companies in town, had they already implemented the GPS, or had it not gone into place yet? Were they monitoring? Do they have a record? Now, in 2016, we contacted all the cab companies. At first, they said it was a yellow cab, and then we thought that someone said, well, maybe it was a white cab. And so we just contacted as many cab companies that were here, and nobody had a record of a pickup at 2400 Jefferson Street.
Glinda acknowledges that the local law enforcement agencies are doing some work on the investigation.
We asked them to go to the bank and get the report that the bank submitted. Sister had talked to their compliance officer, or I'm not sure if that's her title or not, but they had said, we did a report the day he came in. And again, remember, they closed his bank account the very next day and mailed a check to my aunt for what was left in his bank account, because he apparently caused such a ruckus in the bank. Detective Miller, Ken Miller, who is a detective with the Cheatham County Sheriff's Office, he goes to the bank to get the report. Well, the bank tells them that they need a subpoena to release the report. He says, okay. He goes to the judge. He gets the subpoena signed. He delivers it to the bank. And then my sister calls and says, do you have the report? Because we are just waiting on with bated breath about what's in the report. And he says, well, they have 30 days to act on it. And the girl's going on vacation and we'll get it. Literally, the bank waited 20 plus days to hand that over. They didn't even hand over everything because they did not hand over the letter showing they closed his account. What they handed over was some emails about one person's account of what happened and how he came in and he asked for Vicky and he had no expression on his face. They didn't say one thing about him yelling out, making a scene or anything. He just sat there expressionless and he wanted a withdrawal. And then he asked her, could she take him somewhere? And she told him no. And it's like, well, did you ask him where he wanted to go? Then they see him leave the bank and get back in the cab. And then he left. So it's really weird because the bank then hires an off-duty Keenum County sheriff's officer to stand in the bank because they're afraid he's going to come back.
One thing that has come up and has given them a little bit of hope is that a credit report on John showed activity after he was last seen.
Well, they said we showed some activity with a utility in 2016, and it was connected to an address in Nashville that my dad was not connected to our knowledge at all. Through some detective work, my sisters and I have been able to figure out it was a cell phone. There's no active cell phone with that social today, but, you know, I think maybe they tried to do one in 2016. I'm not sure.
Due to jurisdictional issues, John's case was eventually transferred from Metro PD, the department that John's wife had worked for, to Cheatham County. After hearing the family's account of what the investigation into finding John has entailed, we contacted the Cheatham County Sheriff's Office to see if we could speak to Detective Miller. He agreed, and we were able to ask some of the questions that came up when we were researching this case.
My name is Lieutenant Kenneth Miller, and I am the lieutenant over the criminal investigation division of the Cheatham County Sheriff's Office. We basically work on anything. I have, with counting myself, I have four investigators for a county of approximately 42,000 people. And we pretty much work everything from child abuse, child sex abuse, rapes, burglaries, robberies, aggravated assaults, homicides, pretty much anything that comes through the door, we pretty much all have to work. We were first contacted back by actually the medical examiner's office out of Nashville. I had received a phone call from them explaining to me that that this family was wanting to get in touch with us and ask if they could, because of their father missing. And I don't know if you're familiar with the NAMIS program. They were contacting the medical examiner's office about that because of some unidentifieds that are currently at the medical examiner's office. So they wanted to contact us as well because Mr. Brewer was actually last seen in May of 2013 at a bank in my county. There was some sort of an incident. That's one of the disputes going on here. The family believes that there was a lot more. The bank has some things documented in their emails that they, you know, their interdepartmental emails that they sent out. There was some sort of a disturbance at the bank. Mr. Brewer came in to withdraw some money. One of the tellers at the time stated that he, in the email, that, you know, he was looking at her funny. He was kind of loud, and he demanded to only speak with this particular teller. That particular teller was actually busy with somebody else. He was eventually able to speak with her. They conducted their business. He withdrew $500 from his account and wanted somebody to give him from the bank to give him a ride. When nobody from the bank was able to or willing to, he got back into the cab that he came there in and left. They actually dispatched an officer out that day, and one of the things in the initial report that the officer went out back in May of 2013, they called it in that he had shown up at the bank, asked an employee for a ride. They had heard he had escaped from a mental hospital, and that's why they called for an officer. Then it says the sister, and then a little bit later than that, it says the sister just called. They were looking for him, and he walked away from his group home. That was about it. When my officers got there, they had about a 10-minute response time, and by the time they got on scene, he was already gone.
One thing we wanted to ask Detective Miller was if there were any court or medical records that could give us some insight into John's state of mind on the day he disappeared.
Absolutely nothing. Those records are pretty difficult to obtain, and not knowing what hospital he had been in or anything of that, it's kind of there's Nashville has quite a few hospitals that will deal with psychiatric patients, and they're very protective of those records for good reason. I've not been able to get anybody to verify for sure which hospital he was in or be willing to share any information on the mental health records. It is a powerful thing. It is a good thing, but at times it is just a shield. If they were actually in the facility, we can get a court order to get some information, but there's still some of it that they just will not release. They say, take us to court. I mean, and I've actually had them tell me that. Say, ma'am, I've got a court order that says that. So we'll take us to court. Our attorney will talk to your attorney. Whatever the judge says, we'll do. But I'm not going to release this information. And I have to say, yes, ma'am, thank you.
Glenda mentioned that a routine check of John's Social Security number showed that it had been used to open up a utility after the time he was last seen. We asked Detective Miller what that means and if there's any significance to it.
It could be that, you know, that they're still getting mail at that address, or somebody is just continuing a utility like a trash service. That's very common. Some people will be getting a trash service to a certain address. The trash company really doesn't care who's paying, whose name's on the bill, as long as they're getting their check every month. I've run into that quite often, especially like we do the same kind of searches when we're looking for fugitives with warrants. You know, we conduct the same things, credit checks. We get the Marshal Service, or we get, you know, ROCIC, or we use a lot of different resources to try to see what we can find. And I've used most of those to try to find him as well. Just short of, you know, because he doesn't have a criminal warrant, I'm limited in what I can do on some of those databases because they have to be for criminal reasons. It did show on the credit report that sometime after his disappearance, there was a Verizon account opened, but I've not been able to get a whole lot of information from that at this time.
In many stories that I've covered, we hear family and law enforcement alike share frustrations about how difficult it is to get things like phone records. Detective Miller told us more about that.
One of the things we deal with on this, and we deal with this for a lot of different reasons, it's a privacy issue. You're guaranteed the right to privacy and to conduct your own business and your own affairs in the United States of America without any kind of government intervention. Phones are part of that. Your phone records, who owns a phone, who makes phone calls. You know, we have to, it's like if everybody is under this misconception that we can just tap a phone and listen to phone calls, most people don't realize how many steps have to go through to even get attempt to talk to a judge about seeing about a wiretap. And then to do that is so many more steps. You have to follow so many procedures. You know, every call has to be documented and monitored. It is a nightmare. It is a legal paperwork nightmare. For cell phone records, I can get basic information off of a judicial subpoena. That means I have to get a judge to sign off on a order to say, hey, give him this information. Then once I get that information, then I have to go do a search warrant to obtain specific information about a specific time frame or a specific account number or GPS location. All of those have to actually come through search warrants, and search warrants are they're a little more detailed, a lot more specific, and a lot more narrow in the scope of what you're allowed to get.
When we spoke, Detective Miller shared his goals for finding John, even though there are some jurisdictional complications.
We just want to try to help the family get some closure or get some answers. And that's what we've been trying to do to this point. Our hearts go out to them because we're all family people as well. And we do this job because we care. It's not about money. It's not about power. It's not about any of that. It's about we do care about people. And we really want to try to help them. I've been doing stuff for the Brewer family as I can, but I have a full caseload of things that I have to do of people that I'm actually responsible for in my county. One of the things that's really kind of odd in this particular case is the house that Mr. Brewer lists on his driver's license is actually physically in Davidson County, but because the property line touches the Cheatham County property line, at some point in time in history, they decided that they assessed the property in Cheatham County. So that's another complication in this case. That's what Davidson County says. Well, it's assessed in Cheatham. We're not sure that we should be working it, and we run into the same situation here because jurisdictionally, unless I find something has happened to him here in Cheatham County, you know, I find a deceased person matching him, or I find a scene, or I have somebody that lives here in Cheatham County that admits that, hey, I did this in Cheatham County, I'm not going to have jurisdiction either. It's kind of that borderline thing, you know. Which side of the line was it on when it happened? The other issue is, what was his actual legal residence? Because at the time, he was supposed to have been staying in a halfway house, to my understanding, off of Jefferson Street in Nashville. And that is in downtown Nashville. If that was his residence at the time, then that kind of takes all question out of it. But we can't really confirm that one way or another because that place has since went out of business. And you can't find any records from that. I've spoke with the Nashville investigator that had assisted them to appoint, and he was kind of running into the same wall that we're running into. But it's not a crime to just decide you don't want to talk anymore, and that's sad because of his mental capability at the time, or what we've been told his mental capability was at the time. It should have been handled a little differently at that time. When I get involved in it, you know, almost 6 years later, it's kind of, I really don't have anything fresh to run with. It's a little harder for me to do much more than what I'm doing with what information I have at this time. And Tennessee's laws on mental health are some of the more lenient. Part of that is just because you can't house somebody forever just because they have a mental illness. If they're able to somewhat care for themselves, then they're allowed to go live as normal a life as they're capable of. And I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm kind of on the fence about that because I have cases like this where somebody that appears to have had a serious breakdown, but he was physically able to somewhat care for himself, maybe not in the best capacity, but he was able to somewhat care for himself and make some decisions. You know, at that point, it's up to, we go back to the court system and all. A family would have to take him to court and get him proved to be incompetent, for lack of better words, before they could start forcing him to either maintain treatment, maintain a certain residence, or a certain lifestyle.
Finally, we asked Detective Miller what anyone with information about John's disappearance should do.
Please reach out to either the family or myself. I'm Lieutenant Ken Miller. I'm with the Cheatham County Sheriff's Office. And my phone number is area code 615-792-2021. So at this point, if somebody has anonymous information, please share it. We just want to get some answers for Mr. Brewer's family. Ideally, we hope to find him alive and well somewhere and just saying, you know, I just needed to check out for a little while and get myself back together. That's our ideal, perfect solution to this. But if it's something else, then we at least need to get them some answers so they can have some closure. I can't begin to imagine how hard it is to not know what happened to your loved one. I can't even begin to.
So what happened to John Brewer on May 8th, 2013? We know that he went to the bank, and the bank says that he left in a cab. While at the bank, he took out $500. What was that money for? And where was he going when he left? Did he go visit his wife, who lived just miles from the bank, and something happened? Has she shared everything she knows with law enforcement? We know that John's behavior at the bank was alarming to the employees. Did he have a medical or mental health event and just hasn't been found? Or did John Brewer just walk away and decide to start over? It's hard to guess what was going through John's mind that day. We don't know what his mental state was like. This story is such a mystery with so few clues as to what happened to him on that day after he left the bank. A lot of time was lost with him not being reported missing until 3 years after he was last seen. And there's another mystery within that mystery. The halfway house said that they reported him missing to Metro PD, the same department that his wife had worked for. His sister had called Metro PD and they came out to her house and spoke with her. But somehow, all evidence of him being reported back in 2013, including the report from the halfway house, a call from his sister, and the report from investigators who sat down with his sister, like John, all disappeared. At the time of his disappearance, John Brewer was 69 years old. He is approximately 6 feet tall and weighing about 215 pounds. He has gray hair and brown eyes. He may be in need of medical attention. If you have any information about the disappearance of John Brewer, you're urged to call the Cheatham County Sheriff's Office at 615-792-2021. You can follow the search for John on social media at Missing John Adam Brewer.
We have a Facebook page. We're constantly, every time there's a body that shows up or remains, you know, they find bones, we always are calling people looking, trying to find out, you know, what the situation is. I grew up as my father in law enforcement. I know it's a dangerous job. There's so many sacrifices. But at the end of the day, I'm just like, you have failed us. You are here to investigate the problem.
This is a sad situation for their family, and I do feel for them, and I do understand their frustration and even at times their animosity. I can't tell them that they're wrong for feeling the way that they are. That's not right.
That brings us to the end of episode 191. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. You can follow the show on Facebook, where we have a page and a private discussion group for The Vanished. You can find me on Twitter at TheVanishedPod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Arizona. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.